Do you like wrestling trivia? Then check out the 5-Star Match Game, the pro wrestling quiz show. I'm Joe Gagne, and every episode, I grill 3 contestants with 5 rounds of power-packed wrestling trivia. We have over 30 evergreen episodes in the archives covering WWE, AEW, Japan, Mexico, and much, 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 much more. Play along at home and check it out today.
Love Japanese pro wrestling? Want coverage of the entire scene? Men's and women's promotions from New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, All Japan, DDT, Marigold, Gold, and more? Then Wrestling Omakase is the podcast for you. Hosted by a 23-year Puro Watching veteran, that's me, John Carroll, and a rotating cast of co-hosts, we bring you a passionate, knowledgeable look at the wide world of Japanese wrestling. Wrestling Omakase is right here on the Voices of Wrestling Network. Check us out on any podcast app or feed today.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, as always, Jesse Collings, here on a Sunday evening, flying solo. And the reason I am doing this show is because I am going to review both AEW All In and Ring of Honor's Supercard of Honor. The reason I'm deciding to do this is A, I have a lot to say about both shows, but B, also with our friends at the flagship busy on their vacations, there's a void of AEW All In content review, I think. So I am going to step up and provide some of that post-show content. I know this is obviously coming on Sunday evening. I listened to The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy, and they had their review, which I recommend checking out for anyone who hasn't listened to that already. But I figured I would also provide a review because if you're like me, today I was at the gym and I had already listened to The Good, The Bad, The Hungy review, and I was just like, there's such a limited amount of what I feel like is high quality reviews for a show like All In, just because I've become so jaded with so many people's analysis of AEW in particular. I think there are people like me that are out there that are like, man, I loved that show. There's so much to talk about, but who's talking about it, and who's talking about it that I trust, and who's talking about it that I listen to? And there's just not that many people right now for me that are really doing an earnest job doing that. So I figured I would try and put together something for people. If you're like me and you're listening to this like on a Monday and you're starved for some analysis, you're starved for someone else's perspective on the show, hopefully I can provide that. The reason I'm doing this on Sunday evening is because I did not watch this show live. I was busy on Saturday, and so I knew I wasn't going to be able to watch All In live. So I had to do my absolute best to avoid spoilers. And if you're like me, like when I take out my phone, like a bunch of the apps I'm going to use are going to, if I open one of them, it's probably going to tell me something about the show. If I open a social media app that I go on, I'm probably going to inadvertently see some AEW news. So for me, it was very hard to avoid spoilers, to avoid seeing just that one little thing like, oh, a thumbnail with, you know, Kazuchika Okada, and he's still got the title, or he's holding the new unified title. I was like, oh no, now I know Okada won. So it's tough to avoid that kind of stuff like that, but I actually managed to make it all the way to Sunday morning without having any spoilers. So I watched the show spoiler free on Sunday morning, and I did not know the result of the main event. As I discussed with Trevor Dame in my kind of preview episode of All In that we recorded last week, I felt pretty good about Hangman Page winning, and that is exactly what happened. He is the new AEW World Champion. He defeats Jon Moxley in the Texas Deathmatch in the main event, and I think this was 100% the right idea. As I discussed with Trevor, I think if you went with the option of Moxley retaining, I just think there was so much of a there's a lot of downside that could happen. I think the fans really wanted to see Hangman win. There were some fans who were going to get very frustrated if he didn't win. I think the build to Hangman's eventual triumph was done really well, and there's not a lot to be gained by delaying that coronation and letting Moxley hold the title for a few more months, or maybe shifting the title onto Darby Allin or someone else like that. I think that now was clearly the time to do that, and I think that was reflected in the match and the kind of reaction to the finish of the match. I thought the match was excellent. It was exactly what I thought the match was going to be, which was we've seen enough of these Texas death matches to kind of know how they work. It's going to be really bloody. There's going to be barbed wire. There's going to be these big spots. There are going to be these dramatic counts to 10. It was all of that kind of stuff that we've seen and we've become used to seeing in these Texas death matches. And it also had kind of like a cavalcade of people running in, which is something that I thought was also very likely to happen because the way the build to this match had been, it had involved so many different parties either aligning themselves with the Death Riders or Hangman Page. So I knew that the Death Riders were going to get involved. You knew that, Ospreay was going to come out, and then you knew that Swerve was going to come out. You knew that the Young Bucks were going to come out. And of course, the two surprises were Bryan Danielson and Darby Allin coming out towards the very end of the match. And that obviously made a lot of sense because of how those guys were kind of written off of the company. Darby was assaulted by the Death Riders and lost his title shot, which ultimately ended up being the title shot that Moxley used to defeat Bryan Danielson, ending his career. So those guys obviously coming back into the picture made sense. So it was this big, sweeping epic of a match. I think it was one of the guys from Pro Wrestling Torch described it as the Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns WrestleMania main event, if it had been directed by Quentin Tarantino, because obviously it was very bloody and gory. And I do think that that is kind of a good assessment of the match, just because it was this huge culminating epic match with all of these different characters that we've seen run in and out. It made a lot more sense than the Cody Rhodes versus Roman Reigns match, and also was an infinitely better wrestling match. These were two guys that put in a huge effort to deliver a big performance, and it was the perfect main event for the show. It was the perfect way to go off the air for what was a huge triumph from a show, from a business perspective, from a booking perspective, and then finally from a storyline perspective, seeing Hangman Page win, recapture the world title, get the big pop, everyone's celebrating the ring, fans are going crazy. It was a show that made you feel good about being a wrestling fan. It made it feel like that spending so much of your free time watching this product and talking about this product and thinking about the product and feeling like it's all worth it. Not just because if you're a Hangman Page fan, you saw the guy that you wanted to win, but you saw it in such a way that felt rewarding and earned and triumphant. And that is what pro wrestling is about. I said on my podcast with Trevor Dame last week, pro wrestling is about heroes. It is about getting people that have a strong emotional connection with the audience and people feel invested in, and making those people feel like larger than life figures. That's ultimately what the cornerstone of professional wrestling and really any form of entertainment is really about. Any story-driven entertainment is about characters you believe in and invest your time in, and ultimately seeing them triumph in some way. And that was how this match played out. It was Hangman Page overcoming the odds, getting help from his friends, burying the hatchet with Swerve on screen, and it culminating in him winning the world title. And that is one of the main reasons I think AEW has been so successful lately. It is because they have done a great job creating heroes, creating baby faces. And whether or not you are the biggest Hangman Page fan in the world, or you wanted somebody else to maybe get the world title shot off of Moxley, maybe you wanted Swerve to do it, maybe you wanted Darby Allin to do it, maybe you wanted Will Ospreay to do it, There were a bunch of different ways you could go about this, but I think it's hard to deny that nobody in AEW has the kind of special connection with the audience that Hangman Page does. He is the person that has that kind of special connection that only the very top babyfaces have. And kind of the ironic thing about this is, go back in time to Hangman Page losing the world title the first time, which he lost to CM Punk. And there actually are a lot of similarities between CM Punk and Hangman Page in regards to their connections with their audience. There is this impression that, like, CM Punk did a great job blending what felt like his real life persona into his character. It's obviously the worked shoot promo that he did on Raw. Was the pipe bomb promo was obviously a huge part of that, but part of the reason fans felt so connected to CM Punk in the way that they never really felt that connected to John Cena was because they felt like they connected with CM Punk the person and what he stood for and the way he vocalized his opinions, and it resonated with people and created this really important bond between this on-screen wrestler and the fans that are watching the show and paying tickets to see it live. And I do think fans feel that way about Hangman Page. They feel like they know Adam Page, Steven Woltz, the person, not just the wrestling character. And they feel like they will really want to live and die with what this guy's character does. So if that is he's winning matches, he's losing matches, he's winning the world title, he's getting screwed out of the world title, all of that stuff resonates just a little bit more because he has that connection, and people feel like they have a personal stake in this guy's success. And it's very rare to do that. And so it's kind of ironic that Punk and Hangman share those similarities. Obviously, those are very different people. And part of the issue with Punk, and especially over the last few weeks with Punk in Saudi Arabia and Punk really doing, the apology tour and the press conference in Saudi Arabia, was feeling like Punk really betrayed his own fans because he was just exposed as a phony, that he wouldn't really stand up and do what we considered to be the right thing just for a little bit of extra money. And it, like we said, it's a high fall off such a high horse. And that was kind of what happened to Punk. And hopefully, there's never a reckoning like that between Hangman Page, because that would not be good for the wrestling industry for Page to be undermined like that. But it is just that kind of special connection. He is the baby face. He is number one. He is the face of AEW. Tony Khan said it in the press conference last night. He said Hangman Page is the face of All Elite Wrestling. And it'll be interesting to see where he goes next, what challenges are out there. Obviously, MJF won the Casino Gauntlet, so he looks like he will be a major opponent for Page going forward. And they've obviously been planting the seeds between them for a while. They obviously already had a match at Revolution, and they've been kind of sniping at each other backstage ever since. So that's someone who's going to get involved probably pretty soon. You expect that to be a pay-per-view main event, maybe for All Out in Toronto in September. You also have, of course, Forbidden Door coming up. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. It's probably going to be a New Japan Pro Wrestler. I think it makes the most sense for it to be Gabe Kidd, just based on Kidd's role as a member of the Death Riders. It seemed to be a logical extension if you wanted a New Japan Pro Wrestler that had kind of a built-in storyline already with Hangman Page. Show is also going to be in the United Kingdom, which is where Gabe Kidd is from. So there makes some sense there. I know I floated that idea to some New Japan fans. They said, well, Gabe Kidd, he just won the white belt in New Japan Pro Wrestling, and why would they have their champion lose to another guy? I personally don't think that Gabe Kidd losing to Hangman Page would really be that significant in terms of a deterrence to Gabe Kidd's momentum. I think him working a main event in England that will probably have a really hot crowd and pushing perhaps the most over wrestler in the world. I guess Mystico is probably the most over wrestler in the world, but behind him, probably someone like Hangman Page losing to him in a major match. I wouldn't see it as any form of burial, but people get prickly about that kind of stuff. So maybe it's not Gabe Kidd, maybe it's someone else in New Japan. But that's obviously something to keep in mind. I think from a, I guess like from like, if we're talking about like other Texas death matches, it's hard for me to say if I like this one more than I really hold the one with Swerve Strickland in high regard. And I actually went back and watched both that match and the first John Moxley Texas death match with Hangman Page before this show. I watched them a couple weeks ago. And those ones were maybe a little bit more personal and violent in a way that this one, because there were so many other characters involved, this one felt more epic, right? The title was on the line. It was super long. You had all these people running in. I think like the traditionalist in me probably likes the other two matches more as just like wrestling matches, but this is a more important, more epic match. So you probably can't go wrong deciding which one is your favorite. I'd probably still go the first Moxley and Hangman match, but this one definitely has its strengths. It's a little bit different than the other two. But obviously a very, very good match, a match that I expect to place pretty highly in a lot of match of the year discussions and in votes. But it definitely delivered in it that I thought that John Moxley was absolutely tremendous in this match. I thought that John Moxley had in some ways like a career defining performance in this match, because I have not been the biggest fan of the Death Riders angle. I had a whole episode of my podcast with Sarah from the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast that was just titled Death to the Death Riders, and we did not put over their angle at all very well. We buried a lot of them, and we talked about the performance of Moxley. And Moxley has had some stinkers in a way that you would not expect a main event wrestler in AEW to have. His whole feud with Copeland that was very extended did not go well, which is right when we recorded that podcast. And it was annoying to see all the interference in all these matches, and it just felt like a tired, boring angle that AEW kind of needed to get away with when you had these stars like Hangman Page, like Will Ospreay, like Swerve, just waiting to get another opportunity with the world title. Now, I think really since like March, once we kind of moved beyond the Copeland feud, the Death Riders have been way more efficient, effective, and better. I thought it really started with their match against when they kind of started feuding with the Ops, and they lost the trios titles, Samoa Joe and Powerhouse Hobbs and Shibata. And you kind of saw the vision, right? The fans really wanted to see Moxley lose, and then Joe choked him out right on Dynamite, and it was like, okay, I see the vision now, because these guys, the Ops, got way over beating these guys. So you could see if that was, I was in the crowd that night and I was like, okay, this is the pop and this is the atmosphere for them losing the trios title. There's a lot of potential for what happens when Moxley loses the world title. And that was very clear on the show and in the build to the show, right? Which was that even if there were some really bumpy parts of this Death Riders storyline, we ultimately got to a spot where when people could sense the end, when people could feel, okay, Moxley's gonna drop the title and he's gonna drop it to this guy, it was a huge success. They obviously, from a business perspective, this was a hugely successful show. They drew, I think, around 29,000 fans is the number that's being tossed around. Huge gate for AEW. Don't know the pay-per-view numbers yet. Tony said they were tracking as the highest ever, which would be enormously impressive if they could top the 215,000 estimated buys that All In did in I think 2021 when CM Punk had his kind of return match and that kind of thing. If they top that with this show, that's a huge feather in everyone's cap, but specifically Hangman Page and John Moxley, because being able to draw that much for AEW and doing it without CM Punk, doing it without any really big debuting stars, no WWE legends, none of that really extra stuff, just doing it with your full-time regular roster. If they are able to top that pay-per-view buys number, that would be a huge accomplishment. But it already is a huge accomplishment, right? 29,000 fans, multi-million dollar gates, hugely successful show from a quality perspective. It's already a huge accomplishment. But they had this whole build-up to this match. And then in the match, Moxley was tremendous, just being the bully heel, the monster in the movie that you can't quite kill. Did a great job just putting it on Hangman Page, building up sympathy for Page, making it feel like, oh man, maybe Page isn't going to come out of this on top. Maybe the monster is going to win. And then just his selling at the end. So they did the same finish as the first Texas Death Match they had, right? Hangman throws him over the top rope and starts choking him with the chain. First, they tease it, right? He throws him over the top rope and you think they're going to do it again, but Moxley has it scouted this time, right? He holds on to Paige's hair. He carries him over the top rope, and it kind of avoids it happening. But a few minutes later, he's not so fortunate. They do it again. Now, the first time in the first Texas Death Match, Moxley taps out kind of immediately, which I always thought was kind of interesting because the whole point was that, Moxley was willing to go further than Hangman, and Moxley was tougher than Hangman. And then, of course, once Moxley is really faced with what feels like a life and death situation, he immediately tapped out. They go back to that for this, the finish to this match. But instead of immediately tapping out, Moxley hangs on, and he's bled so much in this match. He bled so early from the fork spot at the beginning of the match, which is one of the best visuals I have ever seen in AEW, and I know the guys on the Good, the Bad, the Hunky review pointed this out first, but like the whole camera angle of the triangle choke, and then just seeing Moxley's head, where you see Moxley's, bald head, no marks on it at all, and then you just see Paige stab him with the fork, and just how much blood came out of his head. It was like, this wasn't a guy blading and then pretending, oh, this thing split me open. This was a guy just getting the top of his head just carved to shit with a fork. It was amazing. But Moxley had been bleeding for like 40 minutes profusely, and he's hanging by that chain and he's flopping around like a fish, fighting for his last breath. And it just felt so momentous and felt so dramatic. And every single person in the arena could feel, oh my God. That was that loud noise. I'm getting excited just thinking about it again. Just everyone in that arena being able to feel that Moxley's title was reign was ending and Hangman was actually legitimately going to win this match. And when he tapped and they got the big crowd pop, it was special. And it was delivered exactly the way you wanted to see it delivered. And that stuff goes a long way. I think when we're talking about AEW's business, we're talking about investment, both financially and emotionally, right? Fans were emotionally invested in this match. They feel rewarded. You don't always have to reward the fans 100% of the time. Part of the dance is disappointing them with certain results to set up a bigger result down the line. But when you have a show like this and you feel the momentum reach this kind of point where the fans are just absolutely demanding it, when you deliver, that goes a long way because fans feel like their emotions are being warranted and that they're and the booker and the key decision makers behind the scenes respect the feelings of the fans. And then from a business perspective, you're asking people to lay down $60 for these pay-per-view shows. These pay-per-views are long. You want them to finish the show feeling like, wow, that was totally worth my money. I'm glad I spent the money and the time watching that. And that's really important too. I think with some of the other, like me and Trevor Dame were talking about AEW Revolution show on my last podcast. And it was like Revolution was a really good show. It had some amazing matches on it. But the main event between Moxley and Copeland with Christian Cage kind of getting involved was really disappointing. And that show went off the air and people were like, ah, damn, that was a real bummer of a finish. The show was still great, but the big takeaway at the end was something's not right with AEW. This was their main event. It didn't deliver this. This something's got to change. You get this finish for this show in front of that audience, and you're like, whoa, okay, This is a company that has its finger on the pulse of exactly what the fans wanted, and they delivered. It's a huge triumph for every single person involved. And Moxley, to me, this is a def like I said, he's already obviously been a hugely successful wrestler. He's probably the most important wrestler in AEW history, just from a durability and consistent perspective. And even when this Death Riders stuff felt tiresome, and it just felt like, oh man, Moxley's really getting long in the tooth. Maybe he's overexposed in AEW. He delivers this kind of performance, and the kind of performance he's delivered over the last month or so. And you're like, okay, this is a guy who is an all-time great. There's no other way to talk about him, I think, than as a all-time great. Look at what he delivered from a emotional perspective and from a business perspective over the last few months, with really strong ratings, growing attendance figures, and then obviously this show being as successful as it was. It's like, this is what we would call like an all-time run. If this was the territory days, I know it's not the territory days anymore, but if it's like we were talking about an event like in the mid-South in the early 1980s, right? And like, oh, JYD, he was chasing, the Freebirds for so long, and then they did this, they did 30,000 fans at the Superdome. This is basically the equivalent of that, right? Hangman Page was chasing Jon Moxley, and they did 30,000 fans at the, I don't know, Globe Life Field, that's what it's called. I really wanted to call it the ballpark in Arlington, which is the old Texas Rangers Stadium, which this one, new one, replaced. But it's called the Globe Life Field. I'll add that from a stadium perspective, like I know it's a baseball stadium, it's not a football stadium, so it's not nearly as big as, some of the arenas we see like WrestleMania in, or like Wembley Stadium. It's much smaller than those buildings, but from a visual perspective, from right when the show started and they kind of showed the huge mass of people, it felt like there were 70,000 people there. That's what it looked like. They did a great job shooting the crowd and making it feel like this is not just an arena show. This is not just, us running an NBA arena for a pay-per-view. This is our biggest audience we've ever had in the United States. And this is our version of WrestleMania. And that's what All In should be. It should be their version of WrestleMania. Having that big annual signature event is something that every wrestling company in the world wants to have. Yes, there's WrestleMania. Yeah, there's Wrestle Kingdom, right? There's also like the G1 Climax Final, and there's the Royal Rumble, and there's other ones that take place during the year. Your CMLL has their anniversary show, right? Even indie promotions like RevPro has high stakes, right? And WXW in Europe has a 16 karat tournament, right? Every company wants to have these big annual events that mean something to the fans. And they've done a great job with All In, both of the two Wembley shows and now this show as well, kind of blessing it. And unlike the Wembley Stadium show, like the first Wembley Stadium show, obviously massively successful, like maybe the biggest paid attendance for a wrestling show of all time. But it's also like, oh, it's AEW, the company's still kind of new and exciting, debuting England, debut in Europe, novelty of running a show at Wembley Stadium for the first time since SummerSlam 92. All of that stuff kind of culminated in what feels like a number that's hard to repeat, right? We saw that the following year, where there, even though, the company was doing relatively the same, it wasn't like business had been cut in half, they did, about half the attendance, which was still hugely successful. But it's hard to envision them doing 80,000 people again. But when I think about this show, okay, All In Texas, I guess there's a novelty of the first US stadium show that a lot of people were interested in. But what was really what this show was a really well-built pay-per-view. They've been hyping it for months, even before we knew what was on the card, right? Even when they were, pushing other pay-per-views, they were always reminding us, All In Texas coming up this July, All In Texas, tickets on sale next month, All In Texas, tickets on sale next week, on sale now, you can still get tickets. They've been building and pushing this thing for like probably over 6 months, probably since towards the end of last year. And so you get the sense that this was a major show, and it was built by, main events and big programs. Kenny Omega versus Kazuchika Okada, Mercedes Moné versus Toni Storm, Hangman Page versus Jon Moxley. All regular featured acts on AEW. No special attractions. No part-time wrestlers. No, like, oh, this is the first match that like CM Punk is gonna have in 10 years. Like, which is what, you know, did that drove that huge all-in, or that huge all-out pay-per-view number, right? This was just built on good old-fashioned. Here are the guys on a roster. Let's build some storylines. Let's hype up a pay-per-view. Let's draw a big audience. Let's draw a big house. And that feels repeatable, right? You could run. I know Tony mentioned they're going to Wembley again next year, I think. Maybe that's all in again in Wembley. Maybe it's a different event. I feel like you could take this show all in a show like this, and you could run it in a different ballpark, baseball stadium next year, draw a similar audience as long as you have another big match similar to Moxley and Hangman Page to main event. It feels repeatable and feels sustainable. In a way that maybe some of AEW's early successes didn't, because you felt like there was a sense of novelty there that would eventually wear off, like all new thing happens with all new things. This felt much more like a repeatable, sustainable thing that AEW could do every year. Want to talk about, I guess, the rest of this card. So it's kind of interesting. I didn't watch the show live. Like I said, I watched it this morning. I woke up this morning and I was like, all right, let's watch this all in. And I saw the file and I was like, fuck, this thing's 6 hours long. It's a long show. I actually think the way I watched it, which was not live, it's actually like a worse way to watch it from a time perspective. Cause I was like, all right, I guess this is gonna take up like my whole morning and into the early afternoon if I want to get this done. So I felt like because I didn't watch it live, because I was like, all right, let me try to knock this thing out this morning. I was like, all right, this is feeling pretty lengthy. This is feeling like a long show. Do I wish that the show was shorter? Yes, I do. That being said, I think that this is your signature event. This is the show you've been hyping for 6 months. Just like I said, this has got all these matches. Overstuff that bad boy. Make it feel like you're giving your fans your money's worth. And at the end of the day, your takeaway should not be, man, that show was really long. Maybe you were thinking that at like the 4 hour mark, and you're like, can we speed this up? Maybe this show doesn't need to be so long. But when you get that main event and you didn't lose the crowd, right? The crowd was hyped for that main event. They were hyped for it throughout. They got a huge pop. Hangman Page goes out with a giant pop, looking like a $1 million. You're not like, okay, the show was too long. It wasn't too long. It could be shorter. It would be more convenient if it was shorter. Most things would be, but this is what you want to have when you're delivering a show like All In. If the show was bad or it had some matches that just were really dragged and you were just kind of waiting for the main event to kick around, then the show was also too long. But that wasn't this show. The show had mostly very good matches on it, entertained the crowd, kept them into it for pretty much the entire time. There were a few lulls here and there. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But for the most part, this was a sustained, strong show for its entire 6 hour duration. I did not watch a 0 hour, so I could have watched, I guess it was technically an hour longer or 2 hours longer, but I didn't watch that. So, but just the main card, 6 hours in. Look, this is here's how you watch All In, right? You don't do what I did, which was watch it next morning. You say, All In, it's going to be a Saturday. It's going to be in the afternoon, which is great for a long show because it means you're not asking people to stay up till 12 or 1 a.m. But you say, Saturday, it's going to start at 3. You know what? Let me have some friends over. Let me order a pizza or maybe make some wings or something like that. And we're going to watch the show. It's going to be like the event of the day. That's how you have to approach it. You know it's going to be really long. You know it's going to be epic. You got to just make it your event of the day. Do not like do it like me and be like, all right, maybe I can watch this, you know, kind of before I do some other stuff on Sunday. That's not how you should watch this show. You should definitely make it your whole day. And that's great. You should have having a whole day where you get people to celebrate pro wrestling, get excited about pro wrestling, to build their day around pro wrestling. That's awesome. And I think that's something if you consistently deliver year after year, you're on your way to making this your premium signature events every year for AEW. The rest of the show, I guess I'll do like a little reverse order here. Okada versus Kenny Omega. So this was, interesting. This could have been a main event on any pay-per-view. And this, it was kind of billed as a main event on this show, but I think most people would say, okay, Paige and Moxley was obviously the main event. But they give you this match, on the pay-per-view. And I think the main takeaway most people have is this was not as good as their other matches, which isn't that surprising because the other matches were part of this, very important long-standing story. You have the Wrestle Kingdom match, and then you have the draw, then you have Kenny winning the G1, and eventually Kenny winning the two out of three falls match. Actually, did Kenny even win the G1? I think maybe Kazuchika Okada won the G1 match. Anyway, my brain is kind of fried. Anyway, so you have those four matches. They're all part of this, big, huge four match series in New Japan. Another lifetime ago, right, for these guys, right? You're having the match in 2025. Both guys are older. Both guys are probably not at their peaks in terms of in-ring ability, although they're both still very good. They go out and they have what I thought was absolutely fabulous pro wrestling match. It wasn't like, oh my God, this is the greatest match I've ever seen, which is kind of my takeaway from some of those previous matches that they had. But at the end of the day, you're looking at an absolutely tremendous wrestling match. And while I was watching it, I thought that, you know what, this is such a great match, and it's so great in like a just a different way than your typical great AEW matches are. Like, obviously we saw the Texas Death Match afterwards, but those Texas Death Matches are a very particular type of match and a particular style of match. We've also seen matches like previously on the show, right? We saw Swerve and Ospreay versus the Young Bucks and these other like really great Ospreay and Swerve matches that we've seen throughout AEW's history. Those are wrestled at a certain pace with a certain style. That's different than these Okada Omega matches. These Okada Omega matches are actually way more traditional and very much like kind of like peak New Japan structured from the length of them, from how they start, to the builds, to the finishes, to the, those classic Okada, final stretches of matches that he's really the best wrestler of all time in delivering those stretches. I think that's almost like indisputable. That's like his superpower in terms of being an all-time great wrestler is his psychology and his ability to just come up with these really creative final few minutes that make him who he is, make him, this legendary all-time great wrestler. And we did that, and like I said, didn't quite hit the emotional heights that the previous ones did, but that's like an impossible bar to clear, even for these guys. But what it was like, you know what, this was a great match, and it was great in just a different way than I think a lot of the other great matches we see in AEW. It wasn't as focused on high spots. It definitely wasn't focused on blood or table spots or things that like of that nature like we saw in the main event. And there's nothing wrong with matches, great matches being focused on that. I just like the variety of seeing something a little bit different. And I think Omega and Okada really worked this match like a peak New Japan match, and I think it delivered on that end. And it made me again feel good about seeing this match in AEW and seeing the kind of variety that this show brought together. It's like I said, it's kind of like it's, I think this is going to end up kind of being like a hidden great match of all time, which sounds kind of preposterous, right? So Omega versus Okada, it is, a part of this legendary feud. And I was actually thinking this right when they got the bell pops, bell rings, and they get this big bell pop. And the guys are looking at each other. And I remember thinking, like, you know what? There's a case to be made that if it wasn't for Omega versus Okada, AEW doesn't exist. Because that was such an important match that put Kenny Omega and to a different degree, like New Japan Pro Wrestling and Okada on the map in the United States. Just people hearing about, oh my God, there was this match in Japan. It's the greatest match anyone's ever seen. And New Japan had already been building a lot of momentum in the United States before and had been growing internationally for a few years before that match took place. But that kind of takes it to another level and helps create, I think, this appetite for major high quality non-WWE pro wrestling. And I think you flash forward a couple more years, and then you have, of course, the creation of AEW. Kenny Omega is a key member of that, and obviously you get to Okada coming to AEW, and then we get this match again. So it's a hugely important match. But I think, look, on this show, people when people think about this show, they're going to think about Hangman Page versus Moxley. And then they think of Omega and Okada. And because it is not going to be remembered as part of like this epic series of matches, like the four that they wrestled in New Japan Pro Wrestling was, it'll be kind of like, you know what, this is going to be a really bad comparison because some people might really dislike this movie. But I feel like this is like The Godfather Part 3, where, you know, Godfather Part 1 and 2 are two like unassailable all-time cinema classics. A lot of people consider either the first or second one to be the greatest movie they've ever seen, just like a lot of people feel like one of the Omega Okada matches is the greatest match they've ever seen. And then years and years go by and they create The Godfather Part 3. And when it comes out, a lot of people are like, this is kind of weird. This, it's clearly not as good as The Godfather 1 Part 2. It's also coming years later, and these actors are older, and it feels kind of unnecessary that it exists. And honestly, looking back on it now, you can watch The Godfather Part 1 and Part 2, and you never need to watch The Godfather Part 3. It's not important at all to understanding like The Godfather. And nobody even really thinks of The Godfather as a Godfather as a trilogy. It's really just The Godfather Part 1 and Part 2, and Part 3 is like this auxiliary extra kind of movie that you don't really need to watch. But Godfather Part 3 is actually like a pretty good movie. It's not at nearly the level of Godfather Part 1 and Godfather Part 2, but if you actually were to watch it today, you'd be like, man, that was pretty good. I enjoyed that. And I kind of feel like this Omega Okada match might end up being like that, where it's not essential viewing to understanding the Omega Okada feud. That's going to be all the New Japan matches. It is not going to be viewed on the same level as those matches at all. But that does not mean that this was not a great match, because it was. It's definitely a better match relative to match quality than The Godfather Part 3 was relative to movie quality. But I get the idea. It's like in like 10, 15 years, we'll be looking at like these matches and they'll be like, oh yeah, the Omega Okada feud. And people are like, you know what? No one's going to be talking about that match they had at All In necessarily, but that was a damn good match and everyone should go back and watch it. And I kind of could see that match it kind of being its legacy. It's we know they were in a tough spot. We know that it's so hard to deliver a match when the expectations are that high. And even though we've seen Okada and Omega time and time again rise to those expectations, it was just going to be very, very difficult. But this was a really well-wrestled match. Okada gets the win, which I did not expect. I thought this was going to be Kenny Omega beats Okada. This is, you know, kind of his home turf in AEW. Okada hasn't really taken a loss in AEW yet. This is the perfect time to do it. Nope. Okada goes over. Don Callis interfered, and they kind of played up the idea that, you know, Callis's interference was responsible for Kenny losing. But I thought this was kind of mostly clean in a lot of ways. And, you know, Okada gets the better of Omega. And I'm really interested, like, what is next for Kenny? Because he's a big star. He's been really great this year in AEW. He's not doing the same kind of volume that you would expect. Maybe he had done in previous years, but he's been showing he's still at the absolute top of his game. And I wonder, you know, what's going to be next for him, because he's not going to be this champion like he was. So who's he going to work with next? And that's probably going to be a major feud. And then on Okada's end, you know, now he's got this unified championship. Who's next for him? Who is he going to wrestle? Is it like he's still, you know, we still got to figure out what's going on with Swerve. Osprey, it looks like he's written off television for a while. That's what that looked like to me. Because he obviously goes out in a neck brace and gets stretchered out at the main event when he gets involved. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with him, but interesting to see what happens there. Then our third of like what would be considered the signature matches on the show. Toni Storm versus Mercedes Moné. Again, a really important match in the sense of, again, this was a really, just like Moxley versus Paige, really well-built match that really dates back months ago. They had protecting Moné since she debuted in the company. She had never lost in AEW. She'd been collecting all these titles. And then you have Toni Storm, who is, unlike Hangman, is not chasing the title, right? Toni Storm is the indomitable women's champion who is clearly the most popular women's wrestler in the company. And this is why you go out and you sign Mercedes Moné and you protect her and you give her this big push, because the idea is like, we're going to build her up. And then when she loses, it's going to really mean something. And it did, because this was a signature match for AEW. And I think AEW's had great women's wrestling, did have some great women's wrestling matches during its first few years of existence, right? We saw like things like the Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa hardcore match, and then they had their, of course, their cage match, and there were some great moments, but there were almost like surprising great moments. Oh, I can't believe the women did this. That actually ended up being sick. And it kind of felt like it kind of caught you off guard. And it's good when stuff like that happens. That's part of the magic of pro wrestling, is that sometimes a match that you don't expect to be amazing ends up being amazing. But what's better for AEW is that everyone predicted that this match was going to be really exciting, this match was going to be really good, this was a really well-hyped bout, and then it delivers. And it's like, okay, we're way past the point where the women's division can sometimes really exceed expectations. We're now at the point where the expectations are high, and then the women go out and deliver. That's hugely important. So this was that kind of match, right? Expectations really high. Really high, long build. People really invested in the personalities. Toni Storm goes over, which I was kind of surprised by. I thought Mercedes was going to win just because it seemed like, from a story perspective, you could have Mercedes like steal a win, like with a roll up or something, and win both titles, and then Toni is going to chase after Mercedes for the title. I think that would be an excellent storyline. You could get more juice out of this feud between, your two most popular women's wrestlers. That does end up happening. Toni goes over clean, and now she has, she defends, she retains her title, and it'll be interesting to see again what happens next, because the AEW's women's division is looking really stacked at the moment in terms of just depth. Me and Trevor Dame talked about this, but even just this weekend, what did we see? We saw two things that really add to the division. Three things, if you want to count Alex Windsor. But we saw Athena get way more involved in AEW. Obviously she's been protected in Ring of Honor, and she's done some stuff with AEW on the main roster. She was, had that feud with Mercedes Moné earlier this year. But now, she won the Women's Casino Gauntlet. She's got this upcoming title shot. So it's obviously now is the time that I think a lot of people have been waiting for, which is putting Athena back on AEW television. And now people buy her as a badass, people buy her as a major threat, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if she beats Toni Storm for the title. We also saw Shuri debut. She also kind of popped up at the Ring of Honor show to challenge Athena. So it's kind of interesting, but she showed up obviously in the Women's Casino Gauntlet. She's a highly accomplished wrestler that I think they're going to try to protect and push right away. They kind of made that clear on commentary that she's here, and she's here to go for gold. And I think they're going to take that pretty seriously. And then you just have other people that you could go to if necessary. You have Megan Bain, right? You have Mina Shirakawa, who they have done such a good job with Mina Shirakawa since she came over full time. I mean, that is somebody who, I think the audience was kind of into when she would, stop by and work some matches in AEW. They had some familiarity with her, but since she's come over full time, I think she's done a really, really great job getting over with the audience, and feels like a character that the fans are gonna be invested in. And she's held up her end of the bargain, having some pretty solid matches. I thought her match against Mercedes a few weeks ago was excellent. And I think she's someone to watch in the women's division. I guess I'm kind of turning this into a review of the women's casino gauntlet match, but I swear it's not. I'll get to that later. But yeah, this was a really good match. I don't think it's a match of the year contender. I don't think it's going to be, I think that like the Hollywood ending was a better match. But this was a really good match, and I think it delivered on expectations, which, as I said earlier, were really high. The finish was sick. The strong zero off of the top or middle rope, I guess, was really cool. And she beat Mercedes 1-2-3, nice and clean. So really good match, really exciting finish, totally delivered. And I think it just overall, again, talk about the positive vibes with Hangman Page winning and what does that mean for the men's world title. Took this match and was like, really, really positive vibes for the women's division. Again, had been trending upwards for a while now, especially as this Toni Storm character has caught fire and Mercedes has found her footing in AEW. And now coming off of now you're seeing some of the depth of the division get built up. You still have Mercedes and Tony around as their respective champions. It's a great time for the division. Easily the best it's ever been, and in a real opportunity here, I think, to even cement things further. Jump back to the beginning of the show. I kind of got the big three matches kind of out of the way. I'll kind of speed these through a little bit more. Opening match, Trios title, the Ops beat the Death Riders. The start of kind of what would be seen as like, okay, it's going to be a bad night for the Death Riders, with Shibata, Hobbs, and Joe retaining over the Death Riders team of Claudio and Wheeler Yuta, with Gabe Kidd, who's he's a mercenary. He is not a member of the Death Riders, but he is basically also a member of the Death Riders. Good match. I mean, again, it feels like Gabe is going to do something major at Forbidden Door. That's, what was this match kind of about? It was like, okay, let's show Gabe as this representative in Japan Pro Wrestling, and he's clearly going to be in, a figure on AEW television moving forward. So that seems like something that's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, this was a good opener match when you think about it. Like, it wasn't the best match on the show by any means. But it was, a fast-paced trios match, title on the line, guys getting in and out, crowd getting into it. They love all three. They love Samoa Joe, they love Shibata, and they love Hobbs. And they kind of each do their respective things, right? Hobbs doesn't do a lot of selling. He kind of comes in, gets the hot tag. The people like the meat stuff. Shibata is actually the guy who kind of takes a beating and does all the selling, which is funny when you consider his physical status and how only a little while ago he, wasn't taking any head bumps or anything like that. And in this match, he's like, bump machine Katsuyori Shibata, because, he's got to beat the guy taking the bumps so he can come in and, tag Hobbs and Samoa Joe. Really good stuff. Claudio, as always, is always excellent. Wheeler Yuta, like, I don't know if Yuta gets enough credit for really leaning into his role as just this, little shit that the crowd just has open hostility towards, and kind of has like go away heat in a way, but not all the way where it's like, okay, Wheeler Yuta is on my TV screen, I don't want to see it, click. Which is, I feel like, sometimes the way people talk about him. I think he does a great job. Just people just feel like he's this completely disrespectful prick. And they just want to see someone like Samoa Joe or Hobbs or Shibata beat the shit out of him. I think he's really effective in that role. I think, like, this is also like, this is kind of like the same kind of heat that I think like Sammy Guevara and Jack Perry get, which is when they have a young guy that maybe has struggled to get over in a certain role, AEW fans sometimes get worried that Tony is going to push this guy way harder than he deserves to be pushed. And there's like this extra level of resentment where it's like, not only do I dislike Wheeler Yuta, but I'm also really mad because it seems like the company is going to give him a big push that he doesn't deserve. And that leads to this like extra, like kind of go away heat that you get from the audience. And I don't really think that's fair, because I think Tony has deserved the benefit of the doubt, where Tony will not go all the way with somebody who is not getting over, right? We've seen him, for lack of a better term, give up with people like Sammy Guevara and Wardlow, and Jack Perry to a degree. Not totally deinvest themselves from AEW, but understand, like, these guys probably are not going to be the world champion day, but there's still a role for them to have in the company. And I feel like Wheeler Yuta is in that role right now, where I think some people are like, oh man, this guy really sucks, but I think everyone, even the people that say that, know that Wheeler doesn't actually suck, and he's actually in a perfect role for his skill set right now. Great job with the shaggy hair and beard too, just looking like an asshole too. That's a key part of healing. The men's casino gauntlet match. My hot take is, I think these casino gauntlet matches can be a lot of fun. I like them better as a TV match and like a TV gimmick. I thought this one went really long, and I was kind of like, man, this is a long sh again, I knew this was going to be a long show. I was like, It's a lot. I thought it dragged in certain portions. It's a great gimmick, right? It's basically the Royal Rumble where music hits, guy comes down, new guy gets a pop, runs wild, gets cut off, another guy comes in, does this, and eventually someone gets a pinfall. I like the gimmick where like the timing intervals are just random, which is a great explanation for like how someone can come down always right at the right moment when, one guy's in the ring alone or two guys are beating up on one guy and then the baby face can come down and even the odds. And I just like that they're like, you know what, we're not gonna do every 30 seconds, we're not gonna do every minute, we're not gonna do every 2 minutes or whatever. We're just gonna do it whenever we damn well feel like it. And the gimmick will be the timing is random. And I just like that. And obviously I like seeing, a lot of these guys, what kind of reactions they get from the audience and things like that. It just, it's just a long, long match, 35-minute match. And it also is a great way to get a lot of people on the show. And you have, this is your big show of the year, so you kind of want to have this kind of gimmick match where you can just get a bunch of guys who you want to reward for by being on the show. So that's all well and good. I mean, MJF wins; he steals the pinfall at the very end, which kind of, makes sense from where they were going. And you kind of had the MJF Mark Briscoe feud kind of as the tipping point for this. And then you also had Mystico getting involved. Very interesting to start to see how over Mystico will get with the AEW audience. I thought that, his music hit and people were like, "Oh yeah, Mystico's out. Let's get excited for him." I think that, there's education for the audience that I think if you're a hardcore CML fan, you're like, "Fuck yeah, Mystico's here." But there's not a lot of people like that in the audience. As Mystico gets more and more TV time on AEW and he gets treated like a big deal, which they always do, that will be something to see. Like that will his eventually the charisma that has made him such a big star in CMLL and such a big star in Mexico, will that really translate to the AEW audience? I think they're starting to see that. They had him come out with that, his special music. That not a lot of people knew the words to. I mean, everyone who watched the Arena Mexico show will know, like, oh yeah, like the Tony got his music come out and the fans all sang it because it's, the Arena Mexico crowd. Not a lot of fans in the Globe Life Field knew his song, but in the future, to keep doing it, more and more people will, and people will sing along. What is one thing we know about American wrestling fans? Those motherfuckers love to sing along to entrance song. So this is right up their alley, is Mystico having the fans sing along to the chorus of his entrance music. So if they keep doing that, he is eventually going to get over in a big way. The TNT title match, obviously. So this is a really, interesting part of the show, I guess, in the sense of Adam Cole comes out, announces he's vacating the title, and gives this very sad speech where he talks about his injury, unspecified at the time, but it seems like it's almost definitely a concussion. And he's got to vacate the title. We all know Adam Cole has had a lot of trouble with concussions. And he even said, if this is goodbye forever, in his promo, and it just bummed the crowd out, as one would expect such a promo to do. So it was kind of understandable that following that whole instance, you have this kind of four-way that's, again, it's also slapped together the night before, right? You're supposed to be Kyle Fletcher versus Adam Cole. Instead, like, we're just new four-way: Dustin Rhodes, Daniel Garcia, Kyle Fletcher, and Sammy Guevara. So the crowd is really dead for this match, and the match itself wasn't really that good, but I think that's all understandable. And you know what? It's okay, because you want to know what happened? Dustin Rhodes won the title, and everyone was like, "Oh wow, Dustin Rhodes won the title. I'm glad. I'm happy that Dustin Rhodes won this match." And they had, his family came out, and the Von Erichs came out, they hoisted him up, and they even did, they did a little angle with Sammy, and it was a little like, "Man, you beat that title for me. You took the title in the match I was also in." It's kind of like a little beef they might have. So there's kind of an extra storyline wrinkle there. I actually really liked during the match. Sam, I think it was Sammy, goes for a cover and Dustin breaks it up. And Sammy looks at him and says, like, "Man, like, what the hell? Why'd you break up? I was going for the title." And Dustin just goes, "This might be my last shot." I thought that was like really cool because it's like Dustin Rhodes is like, yeah, we might be tag team partners, but I'm getting real old and this might be my last chance to ever win a major singles title. He took advantage of that and he wins the title. And look, Kyle Fletcher's the one in this match who's on a superstar trajectory. And you know what's going to happen? Kyle Fletcher is going to beat the crap out of old Dustin Rhodes in like a couple of weeks and win the title. And that's fine because you did this, you know, the crowd already is kind of like bummed out from the Adam Cole announcements. And then you kind of pick them back up, right? Oh, Dustin won the title. Oh, well, you know, I'm bummed about that, Adam Cole, but man, isn't it great seeing Dustin win the title? Kyle Fletcher's gonna be fine. Tony didn't just be like, oh, you know what, Kyle Fletcher, you know, he's actually gonna be buried way underneath and he's gonna be like an opening card guy. That's not the case. We all know Kyle Fletcher's going right to the top, and he's probably gonna get even more heat beating beloved veteran Dustin Rhodes than he was going to beat Adam Cole, who is kind of a cold champion. Because I don't think Dustin Rhodes is going to be a cold ch champion, at least for the next few weeks. Maybe if he held the title for 6 months, he would. But there's going to be a momentum and excitement around Dustin holding the title, and Fletcher's going to be a dick heel when he beats him for it. So all of that will work out in the end. Said match really not that good. It's I think easily the worst match on the show. But I understand the booking decision, and it was kind of cool seeing Dustin win the title again. Next up was, now we're getting to more of the meat of the show, tag team match. This is Swerve and Will Ospreay versus the Young Bucks. I thought that the Young Bucks were going to win this match because I thought the stipulation Swerve and Will Ospreay could not challenge for the world title for the next year if they lost was going to, I think that was just, I said this with Trevor Dame, that was a great stipulation, because it really made me, like the smark fan at home, think, oh, they're gonna lose because, you know, that sets up an obvious storyline. It keeps Swerve and Will away from Hangman Page, and they're gonna be really mad at one another for costing themselves, you know, a year's potential worth of a title challenge, and that when we get back to All In next year, both of those, there's going to be a whole storyline where both guys are going to be fighting for their chance to get a title shot. Like they would be like the main event of the Owen Hart Classic because, you know, the winner gets a title shot at All In, and it'll be their first chance to get a title shot in a year. They didn't end up going in that route. They actually just beat the Young Bucks, and Young Bucks are no longer EVPs, which kind of wraps up that storyline. You know, my impression was that Swerve and Will were not going to be EVPs when they won. I think Swerve even said, like, we're not going to do that. There's no way Will could be an EVP. We're going to give it back to the fans, which I guess it just means that there's going to be no, like, on-screen EVP, which would be fine by me. I noticed on the website, I saw this going around social media, that Swerve and Will have EVP on their title on their roster page. I don't know what's going on with that. Hopefully they're not actually EVPs, and hopefully we can put this kind of storyline to bed. The match was predictably great. I thought the Young Bucks entrance was amazing. Young Bucks come out like a dressed like, you know, Revolutionary War figures on this like mock boat. Great, like this boat, this wooden ship that's supposed to be like Washington crossing the Delaware, and it's just like on this like cart. It reminds me of like the ring cart from WrestleMania 3, like Andre the Giant and Bobby Heenan rode in on. It's just like this weird platformed boat, and it actually like stops and goes up higher at one point, like it's on a scissor lift. I don't know why. It's great. That's like if I was like had Tony Khan's level of money, and like I would want like weird wrestling memorabilia, like the boat cart that the Young Bucks came into All In Texas on would be something that I would want. And they had like this declaration of power that they just gave to Justin Roberts, and he rolled out of like an actual scroll of parchment paper, like it was the 1700s. It was just fun aesthetics. The entrances across the board were pretty cool. None of them were like that insanely elaborate, but all of them were just kind of cool. Hangman Page had this woman who I can only describe as a professional whistler, who just like whistled his entrance theme with an acoustic guitar accompanying it, which was very strange but pretty cool. Mercedes Moné, I thought, had a great entrance with the she had like the comically large tail on her jacket that had like all the names of the people that she's beaten on it. Kenny Omega had like a live rendition of his entrance music played. Toni Storm had her little vignette beforehand, so it was all good stuff. One other thing I want to add, this is totally random and this has nothing to do with the tag team match, but like Darby Allin, his Mount Everest video, which was pretty funny. It's very odd because they play this video where it's Darby Allin on the summit of Mount Everest, and he's like top of the world on summit, I'm on top of Mount Everest, but John Moxley, I'm coming for you. And then like the announcers are like, whoa, who was that? And it's like, who else in AEW would be on the summit of Mount Everest cutting a promo on John Moxley? It's also a video, and I know he's wearing like his all his mountain gear, and he also grew a beard, so it doesn't really look like Darby Allin, but it's very clearly Darby Allin. The announcers, of course, the dumbest people in the world, like, oh, who could that be? And then for whatever reason, Bryan Danielson wearing a blue Panther mask actually runs out like immediately. So it was like, was Bryan Danielson the person in that video on Mount Everest? It was just kind of really strange, but it all got pops. And then, of course, Darby rappels down from the Globe Life Field roof and beats up the young but beats up the Death Rider. So it all worked out. But I just thought that was kind of just really funny. Just the video was really cool with the Mount Everest stuff, and then the announcers being dumbfounded by who that could possibly be. And then of course Bryan Danielson wearing a Blue Panther mask of all people. Because he's such a nerd, of course he's gonna be wearing a Blue Panther mask. All that stuff. But anyway, back to this tag title match. Great stuff by the Young Bucks. Who, I mean, like Will Ospreay and Swerve are great wrestlers. Do they really need to be coached through a great match? Obviously not. But there's no denying, like Young Bucks being as good of a tag team as they are the kind of the brains behind putting together matches like this. This felt like a frenetic, incredible Dragon Gate match at times, just with the pacing and the fast moves and the liberal use of tags and just all of that kind of stuff. Like, it just felt like one of those great classic Dragon Gate matches, which is really unsurprising because that's where the Young Bucks roots are, and the Young Bucks have really helped popularize that style around the world. Coming from their experience working in Dragon Gate, working in Lucha Libre, and obviously Will Ospreay and Swerve are well accustomed to working that style as well. But just the pacing, the kickouts, like they did that whole thing where they just were all hitting big moves and kicking each other, and like Young Bucks hit stereo Canadian destroyers, but then Will Ospreay and Swerve Strickland short fighting spear and both hit house call and hidden blades, and then they all collapsed. And that's the kind of spot where some people will be like, they none of them didn't sell the Canadian destroyer, and that's a bad for wrestling, and this is why no one draws. And it's like 29,000 people got to their feet and started screaming because of how good that spot was, because it was awesome. So it's like just like one of those things that like the dumbest people among us will complain about something like not being dumb and not being able to get over. Meanwhile, 30,000 people are stamp stomping their feet in appreciation. Just great stuff. I mean, these are, Will and Swerve are two of the five best wrestlers in the world. The Young Bucks are still, I think, clearly the best tag team in the world. And this was, their work. This was their contribution to the show. In a lot of ways, like Swerve and Will Ospreay are kind of overqualified to be in a mid-card tag team match on this show, but the way it was built up, and obviously Young Bucks' credibility and the high quality of the deliverance on this match, doesn't feel like they were missing from anything bigger. We then had the Women's Casino Gauntlet match. This was just kind of mess. It definitely didn't drag as long as the men's one, which I'll give them credit. It wasn't quite as long, but it was still 27 minutes. So that's not like that was short. And there's some good stuff in it, right? I thought the finish with Athena hitting the O face on Mina Shirakawa kind of out of nowhere. It's such an impressive move, and she made Athena look like a complete killer, which is really important. And you can see the crowd buying into her as a major threat to Toni Storm. So all of that was good. You had, this was mostly filled with the people that have been filling up, women's television time, right? Chris Statlander, Megan Bain, Queen Amanada, Thekla, obviously Willow, Thunder Rosa. So you get all these people kind of popping in and doing their kind of, big moves and then some very similar layout to the men's match. This one also did have like a lot of interference and like other women getting involved, and it's already such a chaotic match. You already have all these women kind of just breaking up pinfalls and double teaming people and all this stuff, and it's like you throw on top and it's like, oh, Sky Blue was in here, you know, interfering on behalf of Julia Hart, and it's like, why can't Sky Blue just be in the match? She's not actually in the match, but she functionally basically is because she's just coming in and breaking up pinfalls and helping Julia Hart double team people. And you know, you had Anna Jay get involved. We saw Harley Cameron get involved. It's just like, in addition, this is already a super chaotic match with a bunch of people running into the ring, and now you have other people that aren't even in the match, and it's like kind of hard to remember. Wait, is Sky Blue in this match? Did she get an entrance? No, she just came out with Julia Hart. Oh, like it's just kind of was kind of confusing. We saw, you know, Shirai and Alex Windsor debut. Kind of interesting. Like I mentioned, like, so Ospreay and Samoa Joe both get victimized by the Pillmanization of their necks, right? And they stretchered both of them out on this show. It seemed like they're both going to be missing some time. Like, Samoa Joe's still Trios champion, of course, but the Ops are Trios champions, and Hook could be coming back. So you substitute Hook for Samoa Joe, kind of makes sense. Ospreay, I don't really know what they're going to do. Like, is he going to not be on screen? It's very interesting that Alex Windsor kind of makes her debut, who's, I think she's Will Ospreay's wife, at the very least, his very serious girlfriend. And so it's kind of, she kind of makes her full AEW debut, and now Will Ospreay might be off TV. So that's kind of interesting, but we'll see what happens with Will. But that was the Women's Casino Gauntlet match. And then lastly, we have the tag team match. Hurt Syndicate, they retain their titles. They beat Jet Speed and the Patriarchy. I was entertained by the match. It wasn't a stinker. It wasn't amazing. Kind of interesting. I thought, so like, it was definitely a match built around making the Hurt Syndicate look awesome, which seems to be how most of the Hurt Syndicate matches have gone. This was really more about FTR getting involved with the Hurt Syndicate, and then the post-match angle with Nick Wayne turning on Christian Cage, which is, you know, FTR is on ringside. They kind of get involved in the match, and like the finish of this match is like Bobby Lashley, I think he pushes Dax, and then both Dax and Cash Wheeler are like, "What the hell, man?" And they get up on the apron, and then Lashley just like uses, you know, tosses, I forget who it was, one of the opponents at them, knocks them off the apron, and then just pins whoever the opponent is, and just like Bobby Lashley just beat the shit out of like this entire tag division, right? He fought off FTR, and then he pinned his opponent. Like, so he just like Bobby Lashley looked like a god. And that was kind of like the focus of this match. You know, Jet Speed, those guys worked really hard. Mike Bailey, oh my god, Mike Bailey took like so many bumps. I feel like Mike Bailey took 90% of the bumps in this match, a match that had six people in it. Like Mike Bailey worked his ass off in this match. I'll give him that credit. And I thought Shelton looked really good. Shelton's amazing. Like, honestly, like Shelton is like 50 years old, and he looks like the way he does, and he moves like the way he does, and he's having probably the best run of his entire career. It's either that or like when he was like Intercontinental Champion in 2005. Like, it's pretty remarkable that this chapter has happened for him. But clearly, this is all about building. Now we have the Hurt Syndicate versus FTR, right? This is the big tag team match that they've kind of been building towards. What's interesting is FTR are very clearly heels at this point, and the Hurt Syndicate are also definitely heels. So that is kind of interesting. You also have FTR kind of getting involved in this Nick Wayne Christian Cage thing, where it's they were in the ring and they were kind of like, yeah, we're glad Nick Wayne turned on Christian Cage. And obviously, Adam Copeland's came back, and it's gonna be Adam Copeland versus Christian Cage, or Adam Copeland and Christian Cage. Are they gonna wrestle? Is it gonna be like FTR and Nick Wayne? Like, so FTR seems kind of like involved in two feuds, right? They're clearly gonna be feuding with the Hurt Syndicate, but it also seems like they're probably gonna feud with Christian Cage and Adam Copeland too. So that's kind of confusing. We'll probably see how that shakes out on television. Adam Copeland, like thing that just like annoyed me and probably a lot of people, is like Christian Cage is about to be suffer the concerto, like his head's lying on the chair. Nick Wayne's like got the chair pulled back. He's totally gonna do it. Adam Copeland's music hits. Does Adam Copeland run right to the ring and immediately take out Nick Wayne because there's not a second to waste because Nick Wayne's about to, cripple his friend? Nope. He like had to, he just had to like go to the, ramp up the crowd. He's running around the entrance ramp and he's like hyping up the crowd. And it's like, dude, shut the fuck up. Your friend is about to die. The whole point you're coming back is to prevent Christian Cage from being killed by Nick Wayne. And there really shouldn't be a second to waste. And you're out here grandstanding and doing your whole blown, full blown entrance. And it just made him look really stupid. But he's Adam Copeland and he did what Adam Copeland did, which is he gets a gigantic pop from the audience. Those people love him. And they're obviously going to be doing something with Copeland and Christian Cage as a tag team going forward. So we'll see with that. And that will conclude my All In Texas review. But I did want to toss in a review of the Ring of Honor show from Friday, which I thought was fantastic. It's not as epic as All In, but this was a really, really good show. I'll run through it really quick. Great audience. They were at the Esports Stadium in Arlington, Texas, where they had the residency last year. Really good crowd, obviously, probably like a lot of fly-ins for All In. So you got that really heavily invested hardcore crowd coming in for the show. So you knew you were going to get a strong crowd. Caprice and Ian Riccaboni are fantastic on commentary. Caprice is great as a color guy who just gets excited about the product and wants you to also be excited about the product. And it really comes through earnestly on screen when you're watching him. He's a really underrated, I think, in terms of a color guy because he's not playing a character. He's not a heel. He's not trying to heel it up like so many other guys. He's a guy that whose job is to hype up and get over the action that's happening on screen and the characters. And him and Ian just do an amazing job, and they have for a really long time. And I'm glad with Tony's purchase of ROH that he's kept them intact as the unquestioned duo. And honestly, I would be happy to see, like, Ian, we see, a decent amount of time on AEW, and obviously he does a great job there. I'd like to see Caprice do an AEW. Throw him on a third chair on Collision or something like that. Put him out there with Tony and Nigel McGuinness. I think he does a great job every time. Opening match, Hechicero defeats Michael Oku. I thought this match was great. Hechicero obviously is, he's wrestles that, very unique submission-based style. The crowd is into him. They really like him. So he's seen as, as a threat. So this is a great audience for him. Michael Oku. Oku's such an interesting guy because Oku gets over in the UK Indies. He obviously has the high-profile feud with Will Ospreay, where he has these great matches. And okay, yeah, he had these great matches with Will Ospreay. Like, a lot of people can have great matches with Will Ospreay. But I think Oku, who gets a lot of criticism for his wrestling style, which I disagree with, I think he's fantastic because he does so many little things that so many wrestlers don't do. He's a great babyface. He's great at getting sympathy from the audience. He's great at doing little things to fire them up. He's so good at getting the crowd that's around him. And maybe he's a small room wrestler. Maybe that's where he's best. Maybe this wouldn't work in a stadium setting. Maybe this wouldn't work if he was in an NBA arena. But when he's working like York Hall or he's working a smaller venue like Ring of Honor, it comes across really well. But he's able to have that connection. And I think with Amira, who I think is his wife, does like a really great job tying the whole package together, and you just find yourself rooting for this guy. He's obviously got a sympathetic look because he's so skinny. He does, and he has a signature moves that he does really well, and when he gets over with the audience, it really works. I think he's on his way to doing that in Ring of Honor. And I like the way that they've kind of introduced him to the Tony Khan verse, right? I think if you brought Michael Oku in and you gave him the same kind of push you gave like Mike Bailey or Kevin Knight, which is like, we signed this guy, look at him, he's on AEW television each week, he's wrestling these matches, he's in a tag team, whatever. I don't think he would really succeed because you have to get to know Michael Oku. You have to get to see him wrestle several times. You have to get that kind of slow burning investment in him to really see where his potential is as a star. And I think starting him off in a Ring of Honor, having him work an opening match, having him lose to Hechicero in the way he did, I think it's starting off very slow, but I think it's the right course of action. And I don't know what his ceiling is. Do I ever see him being a huge star in AEW? Probably not. But he has a special something, that connection with the audience through his work, right? It's not necessarily through promos or anything. It's because he's a very sympathetic babyface. And I think he's had a lot of experience working small rooms, working in England, building up that reputation. He's someone to keep an eye on, I think, because I think his ceiling is pretty high. It's he might never reach it, but it's the ceiling itself is pretty high. I could see him down the road potentially being a major player. Next match, $50,000 four-way match. AR Fox wins. AR Fox wins all these matches when there's money on the line. It's just kind of funny. Like Tony's done this. It's like a booking thing. It's like it doesn't really mean anything because we know all this stuff is fake. Like, but for whatever reason, when Tony just wants to put together a fun, trios match or a fun four-way match or a fun six-way match, he's just like, oh, let's just make money online, right? That's something that everyone can understand. It's like almost a way to satisfy the people who are always crying about where a story is. Like, a match can't just be cool, it has to have stakes. And, if you can't build up, if there's no title on the line, or you don't have a bunch of storylines to build up, you can just say, you know what? All these guys are going to fight for money. That's something that literally everyone understands. So, kind of a fun hodgepodge of people: Air Fox, Adam Priest, Atlantis Jr., and Lee Johnson. Opportunity here for Adam Priest, who's kind of carved out a reputation as being one of the best independent wrestlers and one of the best unsigned wrestlers in the world. They obviously gave him a lot of time to shine. It's probably going to see him more wrestle more in Ring of Honor. Let me just check. Has he wrestled in Ring of Honor before? Yeah, he's okay. So he's actually been on TV a little bit. Right. Well, in Ring of Honor, co-promoted the dog collar match from the Dean show, but it looks like he beat Adam. He beat Aaron Solo, and he's also wrestled like Christian and Beast Mortos at some Ring of Honor tapings earlier this year. So he's kind of been in the mix, but I expect to see more of him just because he's a guy. I will say he was in the ring with Air Fox, Atlantis Jr., and Lee Johnson, who aren't exactly like, the Brothers of Destruction or the Road Warriors out there. He's really short. He is not a tall man. And I think in AEW, that's not a death sentence the way it would be in AEW and WWE or other wrestling promotions, but it was noticeable. I never knew he was that short, but I was like, okay, like Lee Johnson looks like Lee Johnson looks like Lance Archer next to Adam Priest. He's not a big guy, but that's okay. Fun finish. Air Fox had this like weird rope assisted Canadian destroyer I've never seen before. Fun match. Air Fox gets a, I guess, televised win. But of course, it was in Ring of Honor, not on AEW television, but good for him. Pure title match, Leo Moriarty versus Blue Panther. I guess like Sting had that those matches with Sting had some really fun matches in AEW, and obviously his last match was tremendous against the Young Bucks. But I was gonna say, like, this is probably the best match you'll ever see a 65-year-old wrestler have. In Blue Panther, well, he'll be 65. It looks like in August, or September. So he's 64. Just a really good, fun match. It's a pure title match, so there's not a ton of, it's mat work, it's submission wrestling, it's all that kind of stuff like that. And, but Blue Panther, man's got his working boots on. He took a superplex off the top. He did a tope suicida. He was working, and this was a lot of fun. A lot of it was because it was the novelty of seeing Blue Panther work a match like this and how well it was worked. But this was a fun match. It's worth your time if you like seeing that particular style of wrestling. And you like to see somebody have a good wrestling match despite having very, very limited athleticism these days. It's a fun match from like that kind of scientific perspective. World title tag team title match, Dustin Rhodes and Sammy Guevara defeat Carly Bravo and Sean Dean. This was okay, wasn't great. The Infantry are just kind of they have a good energy about them, but they're not really a great tag team. This was seemed more just about Dustin Rhodes and Sammy, and then getting the Von Erichs out there at the end. It's a skippable match. You don't need to watch it. Nick Wayne and Titan, this was really good. If you've seen Titan wrestle, as I assume most of these people have, it was, he's obviously a really good wrestler. Nick Wayne, you can just see, I really have enjoyed seeing Nick Wayne in Ring of Honor and seeing him just wrestle more frequently in these singles matches where he is kind of like the favorite. When we see him on AEW television, he's, he's mostly working tag matches, or he's kind of being like the underdog, or like, he's the underdog in his matches, whether he's a babyface or a heel. In the ROH matches, he works much more like a confident heel competitor, and I think you see that translate in better work because he's not being pigeonholed into like the, oh, he's this guy, he's so young and he's full of potential, but he's still really young and he's like the least significant person in this group. Here you're seeing him just work like he is a confident champion, which is what he is in Ring of Honor as the TV title. And here he just wrestled a really good match against Titan, so that's worth your time. ROH interim women's world television title. I really wish that Tony would just get rid of the interim title. Just make this for the world TV title. And then so Red Velvet's injured, but she was there. But like if the whole point is like Red Velvet is injured, so she can't defend her title, just strip her of the title, have Mina Shirakawa, who ends up winning this match, win the title, and then you can go do Mina Shirakawa versus Red Velvet, which is what you're gonna do anyway. And if you want Red Velvet to still be the champion, have her win. If you want Mina Shirakawa to still be the champion, just have her win. I just don't think we need to include interim titles. It's very strange. Like, and there doesn't seem to be really any standard for it, right? Why aren't you doing why is Adam Cole vacating his TV title because he's injured? Now, obviously, it seems like his injury is going to last so much longer that you can't really have someone be the interim title. But why does Adam Cole have to vacate his title while Red Velvet can keep it and you create an interim championship? So that's kind of dumb. It's just a logical gap, and I think I'm preaching to the choir there. Mina Shirakawa, though, in this match, very good. This is, again, I think they've done a great job getting her over. This is kind of an international kind of style match, right? You bring in Miyu Yamashita from Tokyo Joshi Pro, who was in town because they did a big show on Sunday, kind of piggybacking off of All In Texas. I haven't seen that show, but I heard it was very good. And I also heard it did 2,500 fans, which is a huge audience for that promotion and really any promotion in the United States, like outside of AEW and WWE, doing 2,500 fans. Like TNA would kill for 2,500 fans for one of their shows. So the fact that Tokyo Joshi Pro was able to do that is awesome accomplishment for them. But she was in town, so was Persephone from CMLL, and Yuka Sakazaki was back. Fun match. It's not like the world's greatest match or anything like that, but it was fun, all action. They did a good job, building. I think like Persephone, they really focused like on her as role as a power junior, kind of power junior, power women's wrestler. Kind of tossing around the smaller women. That was kind of cool. There's a lot of focus on Miyu Yamashita and her striking. Yeah, but she is interesting because, she wrestled some matches in AEW. I saw her live against Thunder Rosa, and I didn't feel like she connected at that time with the live audience. But I think if she were to get some more time and get some more, I think people, she comes across like a believable ass kicker, sorry. And I think if she gets more time, she could do that on television. It didn't really work the first time, but we'll see in the future. But great job by Mina, great job by the woman here. Fun match. And then Athena versus Thunder Rosa. Thunder Rosa, 19-minute match. Thunder Rosa, she kind of reminds me of Becky Lynch, where just the athleticism is just totally zapped, and they just doesn't move around the ring the way that she used to, and it just feels like she's wrestling in tremendous pain. That's what I can think of when I think of Thunder Rosa. That being said, this was a pretty entertaining match. I mean, Athena just has this. It's funny, this Athena run started because on an episode of AEW Dark that they taped in, I think, Toronto, Athena like was a babyface and she just kind of like worked stiff with an enhancement talent, and that kind of made some rounds on social media where it looked like, oh, Athena was laying it in and working stiff and taking liberties with an enhancement talent. It was like a dumb conversation for a day. And that kind of like something clicked with that. And Athena's just like, I'm going to be that person. I'm going to that persona that people think I am. That's what I'm going to be all the time. And she has ever since just been this asshole woman that forearms people right in the face. And it's totally changed the trajectory of her career. It's given her this whole other look that she has never had before. And obviously, she's had this super long Ring of Honor Women's World title run. And now we're starting to see that translate into more time on AEW television. It seems like she's headed towards a major program with Toni Storm. But this was another strong match by her. And it's Thunder Rosa's best match in forever. Again, you should definitely check this one out. And then the main event, Bandido versus Konosuke Takeshita. One of the best matches of the year. Strong candidate for best match of the weekend. I think most people would point towards either this match or the main event of All In. But the difference between the two matches is actually like a huge difference because they're totally different matches. This is much more of a traditional match, right? This is a world championship match. Don Callis gets involved like a little bit, but it's just a straight up 1v1 match. It's not a no DQ match. There's not a ton of blood or anything like that. It is just two guys going at it, two wrestlers at the absolute peak of their game. I think everyone knows that Takeshita is one of the best wrestlers in the world. Bandido is having an amazing year. This is the kind of match that you want to see in Ring of Honor, right? Like Ring of Honor struggles to get buzz, struggles to get momentum, but this is a match that takes place and everyone's gonna be like, I don't care if you never watch Ring of Honor, go find Supercard of Honor. Go watch this match. It's if you are a serious wrestling fan, you seriously, want to have match of the year list or anything, you have to watch this match. It was super, super exciting. Just really well built, just like a 30-minute classic. And it's been a fantastic year for Bandido, combined, his work in Ring of Honor, his work in CMLL, his work in AEW. He's having a great year. It's great to see him kind of bounce back. He had a kind of lost year due to injuries and things like that, but he's just getting over more and more with the larger audience in AEW. And this was an amazing match. And I think a lot of people expected Takeshita to win just because it just felt like it makes more sense. He's a bigger star of the Bandido, or at least it feels like he's a bigger star of the Bandido. He's definitely been protected more on AEW television than Bandido has. Takeshita's also going right into the G1 next week, so it also would kind of make sense for him to not be the ROH World Champion during the G1. So that also is kind of something that maybe I kind of didn't think about that. Like if you asked me before the show, I would have been like, "Ah, oh, Takeshita's probably gonna win." But now I think about the G1, it makes sense for Bandido to retain. This had one of my favorite finishes I've seen in a long time. Just this. Reversals. He goes to 21-plex. Takeshita blocks it. Then Takeshita goes for Raging Fire, and then Bandido just rolls him up inside cradle. 1-2-3, kind of flash pin. I just love the kind of finish. It's great to get decisive finishes. It's great when a guy hits the finisher and gets the win clean. But that nice, inside cradle to just squeak out a win in a 30-minute match against an opponent. I just thought that was fantastic way to finish the match. And just a great show. This is a great show. I think anyone that likes professional wrestling should go out of their way to watch Supercard of Honor. Watch the whole thing. There's not really a bad match on the show. The tag team title match, a little weak, but other than that, this is a super fun time. So it's going to wrap things up. I appreciate everyone listening. I hope this maybe scratched an itch people had about coming out of All In weekend. I'm sure the Flagship Boys are going to do an amazing job when they finally review this, and hopefully some other people have some excellent reviews out there as well. But I'm Jesse Collins, and I will see you again next time.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rich. And if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.